on a warm summer day to stroll through the green lawns and gardens of a battlefield cemetery can be an experience of tranquility. Standing at a gray granite memorial to a war can bring a moment of learning, reflection, and the giving of thanks. Yet behind those tranquil sculptures and graveyards are oceans of suffering. They contain the confusion of the battlefield, the soul-shattering noise, the stench of unwashed comrades and nearby corpses, grief and fear at the death around you, the frostbite, the hunger, the agony of your mortal wounds. A stone monument stands for so much suffering. In the summer of 1914, a teenage Serbian terrorist killed the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. Serbians resisted living under the merged empire of Austria-Hungary. After the assassination, Austria-Hungary attacked Serbia, and Russia jumped in to defend the Serbs. Germany had its own aims for expansion, though it was also committed to backing up Austria-Hungary against Russia. And it did. Thinking the war was winnable in a year, the Germans also invaded Belgium and northeastern France. Had they ever taken Paris, they would have added the whole country to the German Empire and always been within striking distance of Great Britain. Hence, 1 million British men volunteered to drive Germany out of Belgium and France. In the first year of the war, Austria-Hungary lost 2 million men, including its professional class, which had held together soldiers comprising 12 different languages. Entire units of ethnic soldiers deserted. In Russia, the governing bureaucracy failed, leading to food shortages, strikes and protests in the cities, and evasions of the draft by peasants in the countryside. Russian soldiers often had to attack the enemy with no artillery protection, sometimes with no rifles. Historian Michael Howard says that given their hardships, Russia and Austria-Hungary would soon have stopped fighting over Serbia, but by now Great Britain and Germany were in the driver's seat of the war. Most battles involved only small gains in territory or defending gains won earlier. To this end, all sides dug trenches deep and defended them and lived in them. In all, there were 475 miles of trenches, home to millions of men, rivaling the world's big cities in population. Soldiers would rise from their trenches and head forward into a sea of machine gun fire, sometimes dying in formation, their bodies falling in perfect alignment. Philip Jenkins writes that military tacticians would calculate the numbers of men they would plan to lose in each onslaught. When fewer died than leaders expected, they wondered if they were keeping up with the plans. The term human sacrifice bears too much dignity to describe these massacres. Dying by the tens of thousands, draftees and volunteers alike were treated as cannon fodder. The trench system ensured a long war of siege and stalemate, and by 1916, all sides were relying on winning by attrition, not merely by wearing down soldiers, but wearing down public morale in enemy lands and starving them into ceasing the conflict. This war by attrition entailed nearly wiping out a generation of young men. There were so many huge battles in this war, in Europe and elsewhere. In the Battle of the River Somme, for example, Britain suffered its worst military disaster ever. To do any of the battles justice would be unfair to those lost in the other battles. Yet it must be noted that most of them brought little strategic advantage. The Battle of Verdun lasted 11 months with 800,000 casualties as France defended its historic fortress. The French won the battle, but it shattered their army. In this war, traditional fighting met new technology. Fighting forces made use of carrier pigeons and human runners for battlefield communications, and millions of horses died in service. Yet the war saw the deployment of airplanes for the first time in war, and U-boat submarines sank British fighter ships and freighter ships and even passenger ships. Tanks were introduced in this war, and artillery guns came to the battlefield, and flamethrowers. So did chemical weapons, chlorine gas and mustard gas, used first by the Germans and later used against them. German military historian Karl von Clausewitz wrote that war needs three ingredients: government policy, military action, and the passions of the people. The nationalistic passions for this war were expressed in religious language. For example, one German preacher, filled with national glory, asked, "When did peacetime ever offer us the heavenly exaltation that we are feeling in war?" Philip Jenkins explains that religious understandings, frameworks, images, and stories were embedded in the national cultures of Europe. Such worldviews made it easy for leaders and ordinary people alike to cast this war as a holy war. For every side, it was a sacred campaign. Using biblical stories of Armageddon, preachers and politicians took up the cause. This earthly battle had cosmic implications. Good versus evil. It mirrored the heavenly battle of God and Satan. People spoke of the loss of their soldiers as redemptive sacrifices, men giving their lives for others and for God, just as Christ had. Death could be justified, even appealing in such a holy cause, for their immediate status as martyrs, was guaranteed for those who fell. As Jenkins notes, such language differs little from the words of those today who promote violent interpretations of the religion of Islam. During the war, each nation had its national myths and its legends of battlefront visions and miracle rescues and visitations by spiritual figures. In one French story, during a fierce battle, the ghosts of long-dead soldiers rose from their graves and fought side by side with their living comrades. Britain invoked St. George slaying the dragon. Germans proclaimed the superhero glory of the Archangel Michael. The soldiers were knights in armor. When the United States entered the war in 1917, an Episcopal rector in Washington, D.C., said, "This war is indeed a crusade, the greatest in history, the holiest." Vera Brittain was a British nurse in the war and later author of the book Testament of Youth. Skeptical of those battlefield legends, she asked, "What would happen if the angelic protectors of the British and the German forces encountered each other over no man's land? Who would win?" On both sides of the conflict, even liberal Christians argued for holy war. For decades, Germany had boasted leading theologians of the Protestant world. German scholars, liberal scholars, were distinguished for their application of reason and evidence in the study of Christian history and the interpretation of the Bible. Yet they turned into irrational and hateful militants. One German pastor rewrote the Lord's Prayer, asking for strength to carry out God's judgment. It reads, "Lead us not into temptation of letting our wrath be too gentle." In the United States, Congregationalist minister Lyman Abbott, a liberal, entitled one sermon, "To Love is to Hate." Another Congregationalist called for the sterilization of German soldiers, German men, after the war to wipe out the German race. Philip Jenkins stresses that here and abroad, militant faith was not limited to a few celebrity preachers. It was widespread. Our liberal faith was no exception. Unitarian preacher Paul Diffenbach said Jesus would have joined this war. Quote, "There is not an opportunity to deal death to the enemy that Jesus would shirk from. He would take bayonet and grenade and bomb and rifle." As my colleague John Burens has written, Unitarian pacifists felt ostracized in their denomination. William Howard Taft had been the president of the United States, the last Unitarian president we've had, and he was the moderator of the American Unitarian Association in 1917 and 1918. And Taft persuaded our General Assembly that all ministers and churches that received aid from the AUA be required to support the Crusade for Democracy. In New York City, the Reverend John Haynes Holmes was pastor of what is now called the Community Church of New York. In response to Unitarian militarism, Holmes withdrew his ministerial fellowship in 1918, and his church left the denomination. During the war, there were only 15 pacifist Unitarian ministers. By its end, 9 of them had lost or left their pulpits. In 1936, the delegates to our General Assembly voted to apologize for having treated opponents of the war this way. They recommitted to our principle of the freedom of thought and conscience. For those of you who are going with Lucy and with me to Portland in a month for this year's General Assembly, remember the pivotal role that such a gathering can play for good or ill. Organized opposition to the war was exceptional, and it's worth noting. Women in Britain, Europe, and the United States were still organizing for their voting rights, and they used the collective strength they had gained to go meet in the Netherlands to argue for peace. 1,000 women gathered, though Great Britain denied permission to 120 British women to leave the country. In the Netherlands, they established the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. They insisted on their full participation in democracy and an end to the war. One of our members returned recently from attending their 100th anniversary conference. Other justice organizations founded at the time of the First World War include the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the American Civil Liberties Union. This war's most notable religious opponent was Pope Benedict the 15th. He took office only a month after World War I had begun. He condemned the war, calling it the suicide of civilized Europe. Unlike Catholic bishops aligned with monarchs and national churches, the Vatican was newly independent of state control. According to Philip Jenkins, Vatican City was like a marooned island. The Pope's words fell on deaf ears with fellow Christians, even fellow Catholics. Normally, in a war, you must rob the enemy of their humanity to want to kill them. In this war, Jenkins notes, the enemy had to be de-Christianized to be dehumanized. Propaganda from church, state, and ordinary people portrayed enemies as false Christians, even as the Antichrist. Such accusations of faithlessness among fellow believers again sound like the propaganda of militant Islamist fighters. Whoever he is, our enemy is an infidel, a traitor to the true faith. Of course, the traitor to the true faith is the man or the movement that twists a rich spiritual heritage into a weapon. That's the traitor to the true faith. Things like rewriting the Lord's Prayer for cruel purposes were both irrational and blasphemous. Northern California writer Anne Lamott has said it this way: "You can safely assume that you have created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do." She was quoting a priest friend speaking about personal animosities, but it applies even better to national hatreds. You can safely assume you have created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do. It was desperation and misery that wore down the passions of nationalism and militant faith. Fear, grief, despair, and starvation caused riots on the home front in most countries. In the last half of the war, hundreds of thousands of soldiers deserted the armies of Germany and Austria-Hungary and their Russian opponents. The risk of death by firing squad for desertion was perhaps a wise risk to take. For those who would stay and surrender in battle, there was little mercy. Battle victors would just as soon slaughter them as take them prisoner. Germany failed at its final blow against the French in part because German deserters had warned France of the attack. After the war, German people were shocked to learn of the collapse of their armies, realizing the extent of the lies they had been told. According to Michael Howard, in spite of the territories that Germany lost in the treaties that ended the war, and in spite of the men it lost in the war, Germany remained the most powerful nation in Europe. 15 years later, Germany began rearming and planning to reinvade. I've approached this war not with a hope of understanding all of its complex causes and outcomes. I long only to understand how to live with this legacy of cruelty and not to give up on humanity. To understand how to live with hope after learning what we have done to one another. Such a history as this makes it tempting to give up on human goodness and human possibility. Yet there are other ways to respond instead of giving up or giving in. History also contains many examples of nonviolent courage and of people seeking forgiveness and showing mercy. Our human legacy includes the striving to bring beauty into a broken world. The piano music for Left Hand, which we heard earlier, is an example of that. A restoration of hope by the giving and receiving of a generous creativity. If a holy war calls for so much passion, imagination, and purpose as was devoted to the folly of the First World War, then keeping a holy peace must also require our passions, our imaginations, and our strong purpose. Peace can't merely happen. It can't merely happen. We human beings must give to life as much glory as we have given to violence and war. No, give to life more glory than we have given to violence. You know, given the human history of destruction, after reading about all of that destruction, it is amazing to me that any one of us is here, that any one of us was even born. It's amazing that you are here at all, and that I'm here. It's a miracle, and it's a precious opportunity. We can use our time well and not waste any day. Because we are alive, we have the chance to praise life and help it flourish. We can show mercy, kindness, courage, and hope to one another. We can be creative and generous. So long as we live, we can strive to practice understanding, compassion, and forgiveness. When despair is tempting me, I remember what a miracle it is to be alive. What a gift it is to be able to give thanks for any quiet moment of peace. What a blessing to give thanks for the gift of every new day. So may it be. Blessed be, and amen.